Welcome to Searching for Mana, the podcast that investigates the mana. That's the superpower in some of the most influential leaders who are building the future in tech innovation and finance. I'm Lloyd Whitehead, a London-born entrepreneur and headhunter with over 15 years experience on a mission to discover what drives our guests to succeed. How have they got to the top? What attributes have excelled in their career? Listen to find out. Welcome to Searching for Mana. Welcome on to Searching for Mana, Nick Mills.
Thanks for having me on. Great to be here.
Pleasure to have you on the show. Nick, what would you say the user case for Circle CI is?
The kind of simplest way, I suppose, that I like to communicate first off to a non-technical audience about what Circle CI is, what it does, is that it's a software platform for software engineers to build software. So to kind of unpack that a little bit, in a world where increasingly more and more companies have brought software back in-house, have invested in software engineering and have recognized that either it's a kind of ancillary part of the business or increasingly the core part of the company and what it needs to do to innovate and to kind of build a successful business of the future, they need to maximize the productivity of their software engineers. And to do that, they need to have best-in-class tools that can enable those engineers to move as quickly as they can, but also with quality in the work that they do. And so Circle CI is and has been over the last 10 years at the forefront of enabling the highest performing software teams and software engineers to do what they do and to push the bounds of what they do in terms of innovation and building great products. So we provide a software delivery platform, which fundamentally enables teams to take the fastest path from idea through writing code to delivering that code to end users. And it's a deep and feature-rich platform providing everything that a software team needs to do to actually automate as much of that build, test, and deploy process as is possible.
Thank you. So we understand in brief what the business is providing service level. If you could explain to us the company in terms of its size, scale, some of the figures there, please.
Yeah. So we recently just closed our Series F funding round, which is great. We've raised over the last 12 months actually, 200 million over 200 million raises, so 315 million in total. And that's really accelerated our growth in terms of headcount. So we've gone from around 200 when I joined just under 2 years ago. We're now just over 600, soon to be 700 people. We've actually also just acquired our 1 millionth user, which are individual users, individual developers on the platform. And so that means we work with hundreds of thousands of customers around the world. And we're genuinely a global business. Because of the space we're in providing tools to developers, we've always had a bottom-up land and expand type model within the business. We run a creditization model in terms of the actual sort of payment approach within the platform. So that's meant that developers tend to sign up and use our platform before we actually engage with them from any kind of sales or service perspective. So we operate a free product at base and then varying tiers of self-serve and paid customers above that, which has meant that we've actually grown pretty rapidly without having to invest in people on the ground in lots of different geographies. So we're in the US, we're in APAC. Actually, Japan was the first country we launched into with people on the ground. Not your typical kind of path for a US and San Francisco West Coast based company, but we had this kind of groundswell of developer interest over in Tokyo. Obviously, a lot of localization requirements to be able to support those customers. And so we decided to set up some operations there first. And then since then, we've actually got in EMEA over 66 countries, paid customers now, varying sizes, shapes and forms and sectors within that as well. And so, we run, sort of tens of thousands of jobs, which are kind of discrete units of code work through the platform, every minute of every day, of every week of the year.
Absolutely amazing. So that's really exciting scaling over the last couple of years since you joined. And what has your role been and what is your role?
Yeah, so I joined, as I say, just under 2 years ago as the general manager for EMEA and joining part of the executive team for Circle CI. So I guess the way I would kind of describe my position is it's like being a mini CEO within my region. So the job is to, from very little people on the ground, but in our case, we had a pretty good customer base and we actually had revenue, which is unique for me. When I've done this role before, it's been zero revenue, zero customers and zero people. This time around, we had something to work with that was quite significant, actually. And so my task has really been to build out function by function, to accelerate the growth that was already there, and to put teams of people on the ground to work with our customers, to manage our existing business, to support and operate the overall organization. So my responsibility is across all functional teams within the business. I've kind of gone sort of function by function, building those teams out as I go. So far we're now, from a go-to-market perspective, we're about 45 people based across London, Ireland, and we've got a couple of people in some different locations in Europe. We've got about another, I think, 35-ish software engineers working in global teams, but located in Europe as well. And we're very keen to try to get our software engineers as well as our go-to-market staff into the locations where we support customers as much as possible, and to try to be a kind of globally and geographically diverse organization in doing that.
Who are you, and we'll keep this focused on your geography. I know that you're focused on the whole business globally, and of course every area contributes to each other, but let's keep it in the mini CEO arena. So 45 people now, and you've probably got the culture in place, and like you say, you didn't start from zero. There was some good traction, but now there will be much more. What's really the plan for the next year? And I'd quite like to know, and I'm sure the audience would be keen to understand, who are you competing with here?
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of three parts to that question, I think. And just to sort of start on like building the team, and you mentioned there about the culture being in place. I think, what's unique about an international expansion role is that you're typically taking a company that's had a kind of a good degree of success, normally in the US or in some different geographies. And then you're trying to extend the best of that business, but also it's kind of, often when I explain to US colleagues, and I've done this role several times before, that we're trying to expand into a region, but really what we're talking about is what's our UK expansion strategy, what's our German expansion strategy, French expansion strategy, and so on across Europe. Because there's no one-size-fits-all approach in doing that. There are obviously some common aspects of the way customers, in our case, use a product and what sorts of journeys we want to try to take those users and those customers on. But we still need to regionalize and localize and sort of do that incrementally. I think with regards to the culture, I was drawn to Circle CI because of a number of different cultural aspects that I saw across the leadership team that we have and also in the wider business. But also I view culture as not a static thing, which we kind of establish and then it's set. It's something which should evolve over time. It should adapt over time to changing circumstances. Obviously, we've had to do that very rapidly over the last year in every walk of life. And crucially, with each new hire that I bring in, that person's going to add to the culture. Sort of as an aside, people talk a lot about diversity and how that contributes to culture. Often, geographical diversity gets sort of overlooked in that regard. That I think in Europe, and when we think about what's next for Circle CI, there's a huge, rich tapestry of cultures, influences, domain expertise, skills and talent across the whole of Europe and more widely in EMEA that I would love to be able to tap into. We've got customers in those locations already, so I would love to be able to harvest that and kind of embrace that to a greater extent. I think in the more immediate term, we've had some pretty successful quarters since we've got the team on the ground. I've built out sales, customer success, the field-focused teams, but I'm quite early still in building out things like marketing or business development, which focuses on our partners, our communities, inclusive of open source startup communities. We've really done very little in the way of working with consultants or system integrators or other such organizations as well. So I think there's some low-hanging fruit where we can think about how do we accelerate our investment into and our support for different countries within the region, both in terms of hiring, but also in terms of customers. And then looking beyond that, our growth over the sort of recent years has really come from the kind of companies that embrace developer empowerment. You know, we think about like how sophisticated you are in terms of your software practices, and then how empowered you are in terms of your teams and your developers. And so the end goal is to try to get customers to be very sophisticated, but also empowering their teams to choose what's going to work for them and what's going to make them most productive, set against a traditional way in which like a head of IT would have acquired, you know, got an enterprise agreement with Microsoft and then bestowed a set of tools on teams, and that was what they could work with. So our success has really been, and this has been very apparent as I've kind of launched and scaled things up in Europe, is that we work with a lot of startups and scale-up tech companies where, out of the exigencies of being a kind of fast-paced VC-backed business, they've needed to move really quickly. They've not really focused on like standardization or scale until they've got to a certain point in time. Instead, they've just said, right, my developer teams are empowered to pick whatever tools are going to make them most productive. And so that's been the catalyst for our growth, because they've come to Circle CI maybe for free, then they've started paying, they've started to use some advanced capabilities, and we've grown as they've grown. But we are also very much at an inflection point now whereby, you know, in a world where it's sort of a little bit passé to talk about like software is eating the world, but then again, it's quite true that most businesses now need to consider using software in some way, shape or form. Many reports, including, you know, the FT back in January, said that in their eyes, every medium to large corporate is experimenting in some way with software. So it's in that environment, it's no longer about whether you build software, but how you build software. And so the next kind of stage for us, I think, and this is immediate term, but also over, you know, the next few quarters, I think, is moving from that early adopter territory, the VC-backed startup scale-up, into larger organizations that are either bringing their developers back in-house or really now recognizing, bringing forward investment and recognizing the opportunity to invest in software as a catalyst for innovation, and for us to start to service that type of customer or engage with that kind of customer in a deeper sense.
Thank you. What are you seeing in terms of trends? And this might be different dependent on the size of the client, for no code demand.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, there is some demand. I think like there's some broader trends that you know we see. There's kind of generally the increasing pervasiveness of modern software development practices, and you know that's moving away from fixed milestone releases, large batch work, into small batches, releasing as frequently as possible, and then enabling teams to move as quickly as possible to do that. Set against that, there's like some macro themes around like shift to cloud, adoption of or explosion of the use of microservices, and you know that's moving from a sort of small portion of your architecture into quite a large portion of your architecture. And then, you know, thinking about like no code, but also use of open source code, there's also a significant increase in the use of services via API, open source code, or other solutions that don't require code to be written by your team in-house. That's actually not just ancillary to your product, but pretty core to the product or service that you're building. There's an IDC report from, I think it was kind of late last year, which said that just taking open source at the moment, the estimation is that most products that companies manage and code that they have, around 30 to 40% of that is open source provided by a third party. But over the next 3 or 4 years, by the middle of this decade, that's going to increase to as much as 80%. So the combination of all of those things is that change that impacts your core products can come from any direction. And it really is a kind of an explosion of sources of change. Not only are you moving from an original world where you would have had pretty fixed milestones and you'd be releasing in one go, and then you'd be able to monitor and see what's happened, what's changed, and whether what you've released has worked, into an environment where you're trying to release as constantly as possible from at least multiple times a week, if not many, many times a day. And that is kind of a difficult thing for a team to manage. We're moving away also from that linear kind of process of releasing software, whereby your developer makes a Git push, makes a change to the code that they've written locally, integrates it via a tool like CircleCI into your main sort of branch or test branches of your source code, and then you in a linear way push that through into production. Instead, that's going to become an impossible thing to manage when the change can come from all of these different directions. So a big kind of overall macro trend that we see is ultimately the fact that you've got to automate as much as possible, and you've got to in the end be kind of in a constant state of readiness to validate change wherever that change comes from, whether it's like Stripe making a change via API or an open source piece of code changing that you're using, or something that your developer team has actually written and managed themselves.
And is this equally useful across all industry sectors?
Yeah. There's a couple of things in that. Like if you think to like the authors of a book called Accelerate, who are quite famous in the kind of emergence of DevOps as a scene and the idea of moving quickly, small batch work, bringing developers and operators together and kind of thinking holistically about how you build and operate software. They wrote a book a couple of years ago based on some survey data. And one of the key outcomes from that book was that they see high performance across lots of different sectors, not just particular sectors like, you know, fintech, for example, or kind of core software, but in like traditional sectors like retail, in public sector organizations as well. They surveyed some organizations which were government-focused departments in the US that were also hitting some very high bars on software delivery metrics that they defined in the book. Our perspective on that is we you know, survey data is fantastic. Obviously, there are some limitations with survey data because it depends on the people you ask and the answers they give and the questions that you pose to them and how that might give you some sort of insight and how all of that is framed. We actually produced a report in the autumn of last year called the State of Software Delivery Report, which is using our data, which because we run, you know, millions of projects or hundreds of thousands of projects and have millions of data points constantly all the time across companies in, you know, 80 or more geographies around the world, lots and lots of different sectors, from individual developers to large organizations. We've got a pretty rich source of data. And we saw that actually there's the sort of crossover between sector and location is really down to, like, if you take London, because there's such a concentration of fintech, legal tech and health tech investment, we see some high performers in those sectors, but it's because of the sort of confluence of venture capital investment and domain expertise along with software expertise in that particular location. But we equally see companies in Germany building, you know, SaaS platforms or e-commerce platforms. We see companies in other parts of Europe building electric car charging stations or next generation fertilizers that are very, very different sectors, completely different businesses, but they're all hitting pretty high standards of software delivery performance. And we set out some metrics in that report that we recommend as being starting points for measuring how you're performing.
Wow. So the opportunity is huge, which is clearly why you astutely joined and now so excited at pushing on. Be interesting. You touched on the culture of the leadership team and that being one factor as to why you joined. Let's come back to that. Let's go back through your journey and then we'll get back there naturally. You've worked at some, you know, headline places. We'll cover that. But perhaps we could start with if you could think about really a moment in time or even the first time that you started to try and clarify and think what you might do with your career.
Yeah, great question. So I originally qualified in law back in the day. So I did a degree and master's and was going to move into the legal profession. And then sort of by chance, perhaps, I ended up going and working in newspapers. And I spent a lot of time working in some project teams in newspapers, including at The Independent for a while, when people still were very keen to read a physical paper. And, you know, the internet was just a sort of thing on the side.
I still am. Still love it.
I guess at that point, I'd seen the shift to online, but also had kind of started to read up a lot on different types of technologies that were emerging. And I've always had quite an interest in at any given point in time, what is a frontier technology? So now I'm kind of interested in things like quantum computing and AI and other areas. In those days, there was a sort of nascent emergence of like cloud computing. And, you know, it's interesting sort of jumping ahead now, because we work actually with a number of newspapers where they've created completely kind of microservices architecture environments to manage code and enable their journalists to sort of, you know, write what they need to write and get it live as quickly as possible. And I could see the direction that was going. And I think that was probably the first point in time where I decided I need to move into technology. You know, I loved working in newspapers and still love reading them, but, you know, I needed to move into something slightly different. And so I had in mind that I wanted to go into enterprise tech, although I ended up getting an opportunity to do to work for a startup first off. So in 2006, I've been approached by someone that was looking to hire first couple of people on the ground for a Santa Monica headquartered, what was a Series A startup, a data management platform back then. And now I look back at it, it's kind of bizarre that I was one of the two people that they wanted to have as first on the ground, because I had no experience in startup or really in tech at that point. And I think it kind of also is a sort of good barometer for how far we've come in the startup tech ecosystem in London, that now, you know, we've got a huge amount of talent in many different domains in startup tech, scale-up tech and enterprise software. And I suspect my background now wouldn't get me into that sort of role today. But nevertheless, I was given that opportunity and I moved into that company, and it was a great experience to be first on the ground with a US-based tech company. We ended up selling the business, a good sort of exit, early stage exit, and also perhaps an indicator of the ambitions that people had in startup tech back then versus what it's like now, where, you know, the expectation was you build a company, you run it for maybe 2 or 3 years, and then you look to sell it, probably to someone in the US at that point in time, maybe then, you know, someone in Asia Pacific or something like that. But now, obviously, the ambition is that we want to try and build larger, sort of genuinely, like globally competitive scale-up tech companies. You know, I'm not really fixated on unicorn status necessarily, although that's the goal that, you know, Macron, for example, has set for the French tech ecosystem. But I think it is important that we take companies later through the VC lifecycle, partly because that gives us globally competitive companies, which become sort of aspirational beacons for the tech ecosystem in general. But also you end up with that kind of talent recycling and capital recycling benefit when people can exit those businesses, invest back into the community, talent can exit, go and do new startups.
The ecosystem's getting better in Europe, for sure. But the aggression out of, for instance, deep tech spin-outs from university has some way to go to mirror what happens in America. And of course, you know, if you just look at funding rounds, there still is massive strides to make. But it is starkly different to when you had that experience. Agreed.
Yeah. Another interesting one was so John Collison, one of the founders of Stripe, mentioned at a conference back in October that when him and Patrick were looking to raise money in 2010 with this nascent idea of Stripe, they didn't look in Europe, because really, like, the idea of trying to sort of cobble together a seed round based on like a government grant and some angel investors was in itself a big challenge and sort of a bit unlikely. So they went straight to the US. I think, you know, when you look at the last 12 months, actually, the share of seed funding into tech companies in Europe as a region, including the UK, is the highest share of any region globally. Hopefully that will continue, and hopefully a lot of those companies will be successful and go further through the life cycle. But you're right that, you know, overall last year, considering all of the investment that went into tech, 25% of that went into European companies in general, VC money that is. So there's still a long way to go to have the sort of size and scale of the ecosystem in Europe more widely, and certainly in a lot of locations within the region.
Did that early phase of your career take you over to America, or you were based in the UK?
Yeah, based here. After my first startup, I then went to work for Microsoft. So I was a Microsoft UK employee working in EPG in enterprise software. Because of my background, I'd worked in media and entertainment, worked with you know, BBC and ITV and Sky and those sorts of customers. In the end, you know, through varying different roles, I've spent a lot of time in the US, never primarily located there. until, you know, 15 months ago, I was typically in the US maybe 6 or 8 times a year. I've done a mix of West Coast and East Coast companies over that period, mostly West Coast. You know, obviously, I think I haven't been there for quite a while now. It's quite an odd, you know, period of time that we're in. But, you know, I've enjoyed spending that time and being able to take some of those ideas for US companies and expand the sort of companies over here.
Because I just wanted to ask you, I know we're jumping around a little bit, but, you know, obviously the Collinsons are, I don't know what Stripe, you know, we're in May 2021 is valued at, but it's something like 80 billion, 95 billion, there we go. And it'll keep going, I'm sure. I mean, they're amazing, really amazing founders. But then it was obvious to them to go over to America. Now, with the statistics that you've just quoted, and the fact that we've gone through, you know, 18 months of a pandemic and people being distributed, what is what's your view on if they were to weigh that up now, whether they'd need to? Because, you know, there's a whole tranche of talent that has come out of Silicon Valley, for instance. The venture capital world is distributed. Would there still be benefit to go physically base yourself? You know, go to Y Combi and all that classic old route. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I suppose in Patrick and John's circumstance specifically, they were already in the US, having gone to study there, and they're one of the few, or two of the few founders that have sort of genuinely lived that university, left university, started a company experience, contrary to the myth. But I think if you look at the amount of funding that's available for significantly larger rounds for companies over here, maybe sort of through like Series B, Series C, D, E, there's sufficient capital. Although I think there's still a shortage of capital at late stage, which means that you reach a certain point where if you're a European headquartered company and you've chosen to raise here for your early rounds, you end up being capped by the amount of funds that are available, and you end up going to the US or perhaps to Asia Pacific. That being said, you know, Index last year raised a couple of different funds totaling 2 billion. 1.2 billion of that was for late stage rounds and 800 million for early stage. So I think there's still not enough in total to support that later stage growth, but I think increasingly there's enough for early stage. I think the bigger challenge though is really to do with the fact that if you launch into the US and set up there, or you try to launch here and scale up across Europe and then subsequently go to the US, you're gonna face some competitive barriers. But the issue, in my view, is more to do with the fact that if you're a UK headquartered company and you're trying to tap into a big enough internal market for you to reach that kind of size and scale to then go into the US and be competitive with whichever competitors are successful over there, it's a difficult thing to do. It's difficult because there's no real concept of a single market. It's kind of the digital single market is kind of more aspirational still at this point than a reality. And if, you know, Circle CI's perspective, if I want to go and launch into France, Germany, the Netherlands, Nordics countries, I've got to go and get entities in each of those locations. I've got to navigate a lot of employment law complexity, different tax treatments and benefit considerations, and so on, that you can't just launch and scale up with relative ease in Europe and kind of, you know, tap into that as an internal market. Whereas in the US, although it's not always as straightforward as people think, there are obviously a lot of differences at a state level, but it nevertheless is a pretty large internal single market for you to really test and grow quite rapidly before you start to sort of reach that kind of globally competitive level. Contrary to all of that, though, I do think that there's an opportunity if the European Union could start to make, you know, visas and, you know, considerations around legal entities for tech companies expanding. If that can be easier and more streamlined, then maybe the European Union as a market, or the EEA, can become large enough. It is a larger market in GDP and population than the US itself. So if the barriers were reduced, it would be feasible. And of course, there's a lot of tremendous talent, increasingly a lot of great talent in tons of locations in a lot of different European cities. And I would love to tap into that as well, for sure.
Likewise. You mentioned, it's the classic from uni to founding and then astronomical success that Stripe has had, where you spent some time. But you also spent some time in a significant role with Facebook, another relative success story. Arguably, maybe not recently from some perspectives, but I think you were there in the glory days. How was that experience? Can you talk us through that, please?
So I spent 3.5 years at Facebook, just pre-IPO, and then at the time we had probably about 20 or 30 people in the London office, but still pretty small. Over that period, we scaled up the organization in London to, in my day, probably about 800 in London. I've lost track of the size of the business now. I spent some time in an EMEA sales lead role, and then also got involved in a range of different projects related to things like market measurement and kind of sciences and analytics to help us understand audiences and think about how we understand audiences across devices. So my period of time is very much a point where Facebook was making that transition to mobile, but also looking to understand its audiences across different devices. Also, you know, the proxy for understanding audiences, the cookie was breaking down, partly based on cookie directives, but also based on just the explosion of browsers and device uses. So, you know, it was really a kind of interesting journey to start to move the business from a desktop business into a mobile business, start to also think about the audience that Facebook had and how it kind of developed across devices. And then I think the other theme that stood out for me was we were kind of reaching a point where the available inventory and kind of opportunities for reaching those audiences on Facebook, the original Facebook property, was starting to become more limited. Obviously, it was intrinsically tied to the user growth. User growth was growing rapidly in lots of emerging countries, but was starting to go a bit flatter in, you know, the UK or the US. And interestingly, it was slower to kind of grow and take off in countries like Germany, and that certainly changed and they caught up. So we were thinking about off Facebook opportunities. We acquired a few different companies, thinking about extending our reach through the audience network. We were thinking about programmatic and the ability to have companies buy Facebook audiences, but off Facebook via the exchange, and also, you know, built some platforms in an attempt to compete with Google's DoubleClick in terms of ad serving and ad measurement as well. I think, you know, I enjoyed the period, and I guess I've tended over the years to kind of oscillate between larger organizations and then smaller organizations. I enjoy the larger ones because you end up working with some of the best talent sometimes on the planet. You know, you work with some really, really passionate, dedicated and talented people that have got into those businesses. You learn a lot and you know, I find it gives me an opportunity to kind of add to my skill set or certainly, you know, benefit from having a diverse set of perspectives of people within the company that challenge you and kind of take you out of your comfort zone in whatever role that it is that you're doing. And then when I move into a smaller company, I can take some of that and actually, you know, maybe own things a bit more fully myself, or certainly kind of test some of those things that I've learned and kind of iterate on my own skills and kind of put to practice what I've been learning in the bigger organizations. So Facebook certainly gave me, you know, a lot of experiences that I've kind of taken from there. And also directly relevant to Circle CI, I think the final thing I'd comment on is that it was very noticeable when I went to Facebook that the engineers were doing something different. They were operating in a different way. They were, you know, running their teams in a completely different approach. You know, the idea of a roadmap was not really a thing, whereas that was very much a thing at Microsoft back in, you know, 08, 09 when I was there. And so I could see that they were doing something different, and I could see the output as a commercial person on the business side. And then over time, I've begun to sort of get under the hood of how it is they were doing what they're doing. And now it's directly relevant to Circle CI because we enable teams to take on a lot of those kind of principles and practices that, in many regards, Facebook pioneered.
And as you're going through your career, so you explained to us how you first started thinking about, you know, actually, I suppose, you know, it's okay, I'm going to aim at this. And then you had experience in the newspapers that, you know, joint with interest and some commercial sense took you into a different path. Then you had big, small experience. I'm starting to get, you know, really real competent skill set and passion for what you're doing. How did you start setting, you know, around the Stripe era, which I think is 2017, you're working there. Now, this is a rip-roaring success of a business, right? How did you start thinking about your own career in that phase? So you want to be a CEO of the biggest scale business possible is one option. You're thinking, I want to be an entrepreneur. I want to found at some point. Actually, I want to be the guy who keeps on getting, really big scale technology businesses distributed into further territories. I love that. You've got that experience by this point, you know, 4 or 5 times over. That's obviously what you're doing now. I know it's a potentially hard question to answer, but at that point, it's taking you here. What were you thinking? So we can think of the strategy that you had for your own career.
I've tended to always look at the role that I'm doing today at any given point in time and maybe think like a couple of moves ahead and try to kind of get the breadth and the depth in the areas that I think I need with a view to, you know, maybe having some options in the future. But I've also always been kind of clear in my mind that I've, you know, Circle CI was actually not the choice that I ended up originally like had in mind when I ended up moving to Circle CI for this reason, that I'd always anticipated that I would, the next move from Stripe that I would make would be pretty early in a European headquartered tech company. And that I think will almost certainly be the move that I would make now post Circle CI. And so when I was at Stripe, one of the objectives that I had is partly working with, you know, working fairly closely with people like John and Patrick and Claire, the COO and Will, the CFO, having an ability to work with those people, learn from those people was a key part of it. And I felt I would learn a huge amount and it would be directly relevant to what I wanted to do in the future. In fact, whatever that would be, but certainly, you know, the knowledge they'd had taking a company like Stripe from, you know, in Claire's case, she joined, I think, when it was like 200 employees through to when I was there, 800 to like 2,000, 2,500. And she'd been the COO through that period. So a huge amount I could learn from her. The other piece that was the reason I went to Stripe and what I thought I would get from being at Stripe was that I viewed it as being, you know, such a critical technology to enable businesses to exist that hadn't existed before, business models to be created that had never been created before. And, you know, certainly, you know, if the mission is to increase the GDP of the internet, to bring, you know, countries and, you know, profiles of customers, small or large, into an online environment and enable them to kind of generate more revenue for their business. And what it meant was, where that showed up actually in the kind of day-to-day was I ended up going from a meeting with someone that's like launching an early stage startup, looking to build a vertical SaaS platform to manage like shipping logistics, into a conversation with like a fashion retailer that's creating some sort of three-sided marketplace for fashion, and then you'd go to like a business that's looking at you know, B2B billing and how they can kind of manage their operations as a scale up fintech, you know, a real spectrum of businesses that, because of the critical and central role that Stripe's technology played in all of those companies, I could learn about their businesses and their business models and what was going to make them successful, and so, you know, that gave me, I think, that learning from the people I was working with, but also learning from the environment we were in, as well as, of course, you know, the culture in the business and the way that Stripe runs itself and operates itself as an operator. That's kind of, you know, definitely an important ingredient. And, you know, I think that kind of set me up to then consider that, having learned a lot in that period of time, going to something that was quite early, like Circle CI, and sort of taking a lot of that, in fact, and putting it into practice in Circle CI for myself, was one key thing. And I think, you know, if I look ahead, it's also given me that basis to, you know, probably maybe the last thing I'll end up doing will be, you know, launching or being very early in some sort of European headquartered startup. I've always kind of straddled the idea of being in the European tech ecosystem because I've worked for US companies, but worked with European customers. And I'm passionate about trying to build something in Europe that is a European headquartered company. So that may be what's next.
And I noticed that you have a board position or two, or non-exec advisory roles. Are you what's the thinking there? Are you looking to do more of that? Was that just serendipitous, an opportunity came to you? Or now are you thinking you will, around the core role, have a role where you're advising other companies too?
Yeah. My specific non-exec role was somewhat serendipitous, based on an introduction that I was made by someone I knew. But it was by design, in that over the last couple of years, I started off taking some board advisory roles with some early stage startups. I also do a bit of investing, so I'm involved in a couple of early stage funds, and have made some direct investments as an angel, although I wouldn't consider myself to be a sort of fully fledged business angel for sure. That's been more about kind of learning and just kind of getting some exposure to being, you know, really early in validating businesses and teams and getting some kind of skills in that area. I, by design, wanted to get more involved in being an outsider working with the board, if you like, where in most of the roles that I've had, I've, you know, been involved in the board meetings as one of the execs, particularly the early stage startups that I've been at and indeed Circle CI. And that's interesting because you have a perspective of the board dynamics, but as an exec within the company. And what I was really looking to do with the advisor roles and the non-exec role is to take the experience I had, but build my skills in being a non-exec or an outside advisor in that sort of environment. And I think, you know, although I say like maybe the next thing I'd do is be early in a European tech company, and that's probably most likely, I would potentially scale up my VC activities in the future. It's certainly, you know, what I've always been drawn to in a role in general, actually, is that I look for something which is kind of, if I feel like what I'm doing week to week is quite high leverage. By that, I mean, like with Circle CI, we're providing a technology to companies that is a critical enabler for them to go and build their companies. And unfortunately, some of those companies are making some generally, you know, sort of genuine social impact in the world. And it feels high leverage rather than just building a business in and of itself. And I feel the same thing about investment, that the reason why I'm involved in some early stage funds is that I want to try and kind of use my time, use my experience and skills with high leverage, and try and kind of get those companies to go on and be successful, or help them kind of move through some of the early stages as quickly as they can and set them up for success. You know, that could be another sort of future path.
Yeah, fair. No, well, it makes sense. You'd be incredibly credible to do it, based on, I'm sure, experience, the network you've built, you know, a lot of the Stripe are basically like a fund, aren't they now? A very successful one. High leverage, like you said, that's a good way to put it. What would you say throughout the career has been your mana? So just to make sure you know, mana is in gaming, the power, the magic, alongside other things, the skills that you might have, the quant. Would you say your mana has been?
That's a great question. I think I would say, this might sound not the most exciting, but I think actually adaptability is probably a core strength, and that kind of goes back to like my childhood, where my parents would sort of drop me in from like football practice into the golf club into kind of athletics. I actually competed to a quite high level in athletics, and there's sort of different environments, but I could adapt quite quickly as a child. And I've always sort of taken that through, I think, my adult life. I've my family moved around a lot actually when we were young, so I've kind of out of necessity had to adapt a lot to different school environments and all that sort of thing. And I think that set me up to, you need to be adaptable in a fast-paced company, because the company that you join, when it's, you know, I've had experience of like 20 or 30 people through to a couple of hundred. Circle CI has been 200 up to now kind of pushing 700. The company you join then and the company that it is over time changes all the time. And, you know, to go back to my earlier point on culture, you know, you have to come in with a growth mindset, but an outlook of being ready to and willing to drive, in fact, adaptation, because that's how the business grows and is successful. So being comfortable with that, but I think being able to thrive in that environment is really important. But where I think I've also been able to apply it well is across lots of different sectors and different companies of sizes and scales, that then has enabled me to go to like pretty early sort of pre-IPO at one stage, you know, 125,000 employee company, and be comfortable in those different environments and still be able to deliver, you know, domain expertise or deliver, you know, deliver results for the company.
Yeah, brilliant, Mana. And one that actually, it's not boring at all. It's so relevant for kind of blitz scale business experience. Helps you deal with a lot of the stress and gives you some type of vantage to be able to slightly detach from things, look at the things from an external perspective whilst you're also in the game. Now, this question is personal, so feel free to answer as specifically as you'd be kind to. You have a young family. You have a few children now, all under five. So it's been a intense 5 years for you whilst pushing on the successful career and going through COVID. So lots happening. You said that your mana might be because when you grew up, your family moved around a lot. And then also you're really good at sport and team sports and an individual sport by the sounds of it. How do you look at giving your children, probably in a different environment, that same type of ability and mentality?
Yeah, that is a great question, and I think a couple of things to that,
like, and a tricky one, I know.
But it's something I think about a lot because who doesn't with their kids? You know, you want to kind of see how much of your experience without taking away their ability to learn or their ability to kind of learn through their own experiences. How much can you kind of you know set them up for success in the future? I think you know. Like the sports analogy, I think is an interesting one because there's sort of the traditional view of like 10,000 hours of practice and it's all about starting early. So if you want to be successful in sport, you build up that expertise through practice. But in reality, you know, I've read a number of different books that contradict that and will actually say that having a broad base of experiences, particularly early on for a child, and I think this is directly relevant for work as well, and then specializing later. Is a kind of good approach because it gives you that breadth and you know a lot of kind of sort of crossover of experiences and things that you learn that you can then apply to whatever you end up sort of deciding is your particular area of focus. With the family themselves, I suppose, like, you know, because we moved around a lot, I haven't got like a core of friends from when I was, you know, five or something like that really, and maybe I feel like I sort of would have liked that. So we often, my partner and I often talk about like where we live and the school they go to, and we want to try and sort of give them some kind of roots for sure. But at the same time, I definitely, because we moved around quite a lot, that contributed to the adaptability. It made me comfortable meeting new people, building new relationships, kind of getting into new things quite often. And I kind of, ultimately, I guess I want them to have the best of both worlds if that's possible. So, you know, I want them to have sort of broad horizons. I want them to, you know, not be limited by an expectation or sort of whatever circumstances they face, you know, where they live, and I want them to sort of have a global mindset as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the balance, that'll be a constant effort, I'm sure. But I'm sure you're incredibly well. On this, on the sports analogy, you know, I'm a big fan of Gladwell, who writes about this in Outliers. You have books like Bounce, where that's kind of specific to sport. Now, what I take from those type of books is that actually the real top performing professionals, typically from a very young age, have just basically engaged with doing the same thing the whole time. If it's purposeful, if they really are attracted to it, that's the key. So you've got to experience a bunch of stuff to get there. But ideally, you get there so there's enough time to be competitive, given that you need to be pretty much as good as anybody by, let's say, 11 in this day and age. You know, the pressure that comes with that is intense. So you don't necessarily want to go dictate that to your children or your family. So. Is also a conversation I have as well, the whole time, and try and think it through with
it's my partner. Because there are examples of people that kind of buck that trend. There's sort of bit of a background in basketball as well when I was younger. And there was a guy called John Amici who became an NBA player, but not until I think 21 years of age. And he didn't even start playing basketball until maybe sort of 17 or 18 from the UK. So it was pretty rare that a UK person at that point in time in the 90s got into the NBA sort of full stop. And then more recently, I'm also a sort of big cycling fan. And there's a young guy called Remco Evenepoel who played football up until 18. And he's now 21, but he's had 3 years and he's probably the hottest talent in cycling or one of, can do everything. And he was really late converting to the sport. So although I agree that I think, you know, the thing I took from him, I also really enjoyed Bounce by Matthew Syed and like the sort of the parallel there actually with like the tech ecosystem that I took away from that book is that it was the confluence of peers at an early age, coaching, facilities, the kind of the environment that they could all learn from each other. And then they all together, I think there was a point in time where my stats will be wrong, but it was something like 5 of the world's top 10 had come from the UK in table tennis.
Reading.
From that location, yeah. So I think there's a middle ground you know.
Well, good. Good. That's better for my daughter then. She can have some fun. yeah, exactly. So I think we have got a good understanding of the journey in the bio and the difference experience and, you know, what your mana is and the role and the company. Really just lastly, you know, as the encore, what are you super excited about over the next, you know, short, medium term with Circle CI?
Yeah, I think, you know, we've grown rapidly in this environment where developers have been empowered to pick best-in-class tools and, you know, they've chosen Circle CI some of that time, and then we've been able to grow with Circle with those companies. And that's been good for us in a kind of bottom-up land and expand model. But it's interesting when you look at, like, McKinsey produced a report last year which talked about why senior executives in organizations should care about software engineering and why it's strategically important for those companies. They created an index related to developer velocity and kind of maximizing the productivity of developers as a very expensive and sort of, you know, increasingly finite resource for most companies. That index showed that those companies that invest in developers and in the tooling and the practices to drive the highest levels of performance can achieve faster growth, better customer satisfaction. They're more innovative. They ultimately, you know, deliver better results for shareholders, for stakeholders in the organization. And I think we're kind of just at that inflection point where best-in-class practices, best-in-class tools that drive those practices are no longer just in the domain of, you know, certainly not in just in the domain of Facebook or Google or Salesforce or Circle CI. Neither are they just in the domain of an early stage or a kind of scale-up startup in Europe or in the US. They're very much becoming into the purview of large organizations, whether that's innovation labs in-house or whether that's kind of, you know, more widely and more broadly across larger organizations. I think seeing that, you know, says to me that if you think about like the technology life cycle, the adoption of like high growth, high tech technology, We've come from the early adopter sort of phase, and we're now very much into the early majority phase, where other companies are looking at what companies across different sectors are doing. They're looking at what companies in their own sectors are doing, and that's driving an acceleration and an adoption of things like cloud, things like CI/CD in our case, as a proxy for software delivery, software performance at its highest level, microservices. Use of open source API tools and things like that. All of that is becoming mainstream. And that says to me that, you know, certainly for our business, but I think for society more widely, as we try to increase technology innovation and tackle some really important challenges like climate tech and other areas, that explosion in use of different technologies is critical. And it's you know, very exciting to be part of it and hopefully being an enabler of it as well.
Absolutely. And do you predict that over the next 5 years or so, with that movement, we will see the talent, the technical talent, the coders, the devs, the engineers, the DevOps, moving into businesses like yours, Microsoft, etc. And companies that are high growth, SMEs, leveraging those platforms and actually a reduction of hiring of development engineers and so on and so forth to their own organization, because it's just not necessary. Or do you think that this will be a catalyst for the makeup of businesses to have more of that skill set, developers, engineers, and so on and so forth?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's obviously a challenge where, you know, increasingly kind of globally, all of us are very reliant on a small number of companies providing pretty fundamental and foundational technologies. And that brings an element of, you know, fragility, I think, actually, into, you know, sort of most areas. We're all very reliant on AWS, to a lesser extent, GCP and Azure, for example. But I think like the counter to that trend is that more and more companies are actually saying, you know, 20 years ago, they were trying to offshore and outsource IT and operating IT because it was seen as like a cost to the business. But the innovation and the growth would come from investing in business-related activities sort of outside of IT. But increasingly, companies are seeing that it's a strategic opportunity. Arguably, it can become a strategic advantage. You know, I'm really interested in this idea of software engineering actually being a moat for your business, i.e., the way that you build software and the teams that you have in-house creates a competitive advantage and a strategic differentiation for your company. It's not you know, every company, and it's not every domain where that's going to be sort of as apparent. But I do think that bringing engineering back in-house and investing in developers is a crucial kind of thing. It's certainly, I think, table stakes for some companies, and is a crucial thing that most businesses can do. But where I think that it differs is that maybe going back 10 years even, you'd have a portion of those engineers, expensive people to have in your business, managing and operating things that just aren't needed to be operated by people, and certainly not operated by people within your company. You look at like the cost of a developer minute is $1.65. So for every minute that a developer works, it costs you $1.65 on average. But the cost of a compute minute is like 0.006 of a dollar. So if you can use technology and automate as much of the stuff that you can automate, if you're doing it more than twice or three times, then you should be able to find a way to automate that. You can reduce the burden on your software engineers. You're basically outsourcing to compute. And in our case, we're obviously providing via a cloud product the ability to outsource capabilities that you otherwise would have to maintain and operate in-house. Same thing with companies like Stripe. You know, why would anyone build a payment solution these days when they could just plug Stripe in? You'd have to have like a team of people in-house managing and building that in the first instance and managing it on an ongoing basis. So that just doesn't make sense. So taking out and stripping out things that aren't core to your business, but bringing in people and growing your team that are actually going to drive your core business, your core engine of value creation, for me, I think is not even just the future. I think that's kind of where we are now, and it will certainly grow in more and more businesses and more sectors in the years to come.
Yeah, it makes so much sense. You know, if you think of, so everybody can relate, my business, Mana Search, there's many services, but one is recruitment. And some of the times, people are just referring individuals that they, you know, respect and endorse for a particular role. So previously, we would facilitate that, and then, you know, we'd make sure that the referee was given some type of some benefit for doing that. And this would be incredibly manual and really clunky, because you're having to transfer into different people's accounts and take a fee from a company and so on and so forth. Whereas what this allows in the instance of Stripe us to do is just use Stripe to make that transaction. So when I looked at this 5 years ago, because it's obviously that's what we should be doing, not Stripe in that instance, but to build that would have cost me hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds, and to do it well more, and it'd be very complex, and I need to hire a team or use a very expensive agency. Whereas now you just use Stripe. It's so brilliant. And that's enabled, as you were saying earlier in the show, so many businesses, not just to be more efficient, but to quite frankly create different service lines. And so then if we think about what you guys are doing, it's the same thing where, well, it's not the same thing, but it's a similar type of enabler where I really get the point. You know, I don't want to enter that business line. You know, hire a whole bunch of technologists where there's a CTO keeping the lights on building the infrastructure. What I do want to do is, you know, create the product line and make it really efficient. And so the combination of having your own technologists, but where they're able to spend their hours and minutes being productive and creative for your business purpose is facilitated by Circle CI in that instance. So the user case for that, given how businesses are moving, which is there's more entrepreneurship, there's more SMEs, and I'm sure, and I hope we'll keep on seeing that, there's more contractors, so on and so forth, is huge. And so I think for the last question that I have for you really is, you know, how big do you think this business globally can be?
Yeah, that's a good question. I probably can't answer precisely for sure. I think, you know, the reality is that we've got, as I say, you know, we just had our 1 millionth individual user sign up, which is a developer, and we've got hundreds of thousands of customers across, you know, at least 80, 85 different geographies. But I also think, you know, knowing that we don't have loads, at least in my region, we don't have loads of enterprises using Circle CI yet today. And I know that they're using other things which require a lot of overhead. There's a huge untapped addressable market in the enterprise space. But also, you know, I want and I hope and I believe that the growth of the European and more widely other kind of geographies within EMEA tech ecosystem will mean that there are more and more companies that we'll be able to work with that are early stage. There will be more and more late stage companies that we can work with as well. So I feel like that's growing rapidly. You know, the kind of the growth of the enterprise space is a kind of bonus. I'm excited by both. I would love us though to continue to expand across more sectors. I think we tend to be a little bit more concentrated in things like fintech, which is great, and kind of health tech and things. But I think there's much more to come from sectors across the region. You know, I hope to get people on the ground in lots of different locations as well. As I say, it's a sort of such a rich tapestry of cultures and domain expertise and kind of experiences in Europe that I think we can expand pretty rapidly. We recently made an acquisition for a company in the Netherlands, which gives us some footprint there. And I'm sort of very immediately eager to expand and open up our headcount and our business in Amsterdam.
Absolutely awesome. And, you know, I really asked the question just because I want to get some type of feel for everybody who's following Searching for Mana and myself, you know, where the next Microsofts are. So you've given us some type of idea. You know, the challenge is one that you're clearly the absolute right guy for. So look, thank you so much for your time. Really insightful. We'll put some show notes up. You're clearly incredibly well read, and we could do hours of the podcast, and wish you all the best in the future. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.